introduce the series itself. This is the first part in a three-part series highlighting the SRP individual research projects. And these grantees responded to a call for applications by the title of Biogeochemical Interactions Affecting Bioavailability for In-Situ Remediation. And that call came out in 2013. And the reason why we initiated this targeted research program was to better understand how contaminants in the environment are affected by complex biological, geological, and chemical processes. We thought that by understanding these complex interactions, we're better equipped to optimize remediation strategies and therefore improve the science-based decision-making for site management, priority setting, and remedy selection. The individual research project grants that we're going to hear from today and over the next two sessions, they all support problem-solving research. And we were really looking at having investigators who have had some experience working in real field settings, taking some of the problems that they're finding in terms of the biogeochemical interactions happening in these complex areas, and try to work out some of the questions in the lab so that this would basically be an iterative process where we're finding out how well we can replicate the findings from the lab in the field and get a better sense of what the specifications are for each of these remediation technologies. And so without further ado, I would like to introduce our very first speaker, and that is Dr. Edward Bauer. He's the Abel Woolman Professor of Environmental Engineering at the Johns Hopkins Whiting School of Engineering. He's had extensive experience with drinking water and wastewater treatment processes, microbial processes in engineering, and contaminant fate and transport. Dr. Bauer's research provides guidance on defining and managing environmental risks and how to interpret human and ecological health risk data. He directs the Center for Contaminant Transport, Fate, and Remediation, established to study the effects of contamination in Maryland's urban environments and make these findings known and understood by public officials, groups, and the media. He has a degree in civil engineering from Arizona State University and an MS and PhD in environmental engineering and science from Stanford University. Dr. Bauer, I will now turn it over to you.
Okay, thank you, Heather, and thank you for this opportunity to discuss our research project and the audience out there through the webinar. I want to acknowledge that today I'm going to be talking about groundwater remediation and using a dual biofilm barrier for treatment of chlorobenzenes. And this is a collaborative project through our laboratory here at Johns Hopkins University, but also Michelle Laura through the U.S. Geological Survey. And then we have two consultants, Neil Durant at Geosyntec and Amar Wadawan at Arcadis, who have assisted us as well. So it's sort of a blend of fundamental and practical applications in our project. Just as an overview, groundwater remediation, which is really the subject of this overall RFP, is that we look at the remediation scene, and we know we've made a lot of progress at hazardous waste sites. Here's some data on the number of, say, Superfund sites. Maybe about 21% have so-called been cleaned up. We have a lot of RCRA sites that are under control, over 70% of those, and a lot of underground storage tanks have been removed and remediated. But we know there are a lot of other sites that are very complex, and it's anticipated that it may take centuries or more to clean those up, and these are usually very difficult sites that are large in size, have heterogeneous hydrogeology, and have multiple contaminants present. And so a lot of the projects in this call that that Heather just talked about are really addressing some of these complexities. And there's estimated to be over 100,000 sites still remaining at a cost of hundreds of billions of dollars. But we're focusing on bioremediation, and so in this situation, we're typically using organisms and favorable biogeochemistry to result in some sort of contaminant transformation. And we sort of categorize it into two categories, the so-called natural attenuation, which relies on the indigenous organisms to sort of naturally degrade the contaminants and allow for shrinkage of the plumes and reduction of risk. But we find that many times natural attenuation is very slow, and also it's hard to prove that it's always occurring. And so we sometimes go for enhanced in-situ bioremediation where we treat both source zones and groundwater plumes, either through biostimulation, where delivery of electron donors, acceptors rather growth factors, or actually adding the appropriate organisms, which is bioaugmentation. It's estimated that over a quarter of the Superfund sites, this has been used as a remedy for these sites, and the common applications are chlorinated solvent, petroleum hydrocarbons, PCBs, and pesticides. And both aerobic and anaerobic processes have been employed. So this session is focusing on chlorinated solvents, and if you look at how chlorinated solvents are used, they're very versatile as solvents. They're used in dry cleaners, coolants, degreasers, deodorizers, herbicides, and chemical intermediates. The common ones are listed here, trichloroethylene, perchloroethylene, PCBs, polychlorinated biphenyls, or chlorinated benzenes. And something like 17% of the wells that have been tested as part of a national water quality survey done by USGS sort of a few decades ago, and that shows on the map the red dots, you find that a lot of the wells show these contaminants present. And they've been heavily used in industrial and commercial settings. We focus on chlorinated benzenes, and it's 8% of these Superfund sites have had chlorobenzene contamination. Just to go more detail about chlorobenzenes and why they're important, these compounds are sparingly soluble. They form dense non-aqueous phase liquids, which means they sink when they're disposed of to the subsurface. Many of them have chronic effects if you're exposed to them, things like allergic sensitivity, respiratory inflammation, oxidative stress, and some of them are suspected carcinogens. And then if we look at some concentration limits in drinking water, for example, hexachlorobenzene has a 1 microgram per liter concentration limit, 1,2-dichlorobenzene, 600 microgram per liter. And so there are health issues centered around the concentrations that have been detected at these sites. Over on the right-hand side, we see something about the chemical properties. And typically, as you add more chlorines, you reduce solubility, volatility, and mobility. And so we're looking at a suite of compounds. Typically in our research, we're looking at the tri-, di-, and monochlorobenzenes. So we've been working at a Superfund site in Delaware as basically giving us the background and giving us a site to work on in terms of chlorinated solvents, particularly chlorobenzenes, and the geochemistry that's there. And so this is a standard chlorine Superfund site in Delaware, and it's estimated that 2 million liters of mono, di, and trichlorobenzenes were released from tanks and containment ponds at this site. There has been extensive remediation conducted over the last several decades at the location, sort of the source zone area, things like excavation, barrier wall, pump and treat systems. But nevertheless, down gradient near this Red Lion Creek, which flows into the Delaware estuary, there's a lot of wetland that's contaminated with the DNAPL concentrations from the chlorinated benzene. So there's still a lot of site contamination that exists at this facility. And so the remediation challenge here is that these chlorinated benzene plumes can be long-lasting when they're discharged to the subsurface through wetlands and in the watershed. And you get these DNAPLs, which are these lenses or pancakes, as they're sometimes called, of the compounds. Very difficult to find and detect individually. But then as groundwater passes through them, you end up dissolving these compounds and you form these dissolved plumes. And in this case, we have this upwelling of the groundwater into the surface water, the creek, and the estuary, which leads to surface contamination. And we find that the groundwater at the site is anaerobic, so it's anaerobic pore water. And when it reaches the estuary or the water table, it ends up having oxygen from the atmosphere and plants and bioturbation to give us an aerobic-anaerobic interface. And so here's a little schematic of what that looks like. We have basically an upward hydraulic gradient carrying the dissolved chlorinated benzenes through both an anaerobic zone and an aerobic zone. And this allows us then to take advantage of these two redox regimes to try to maximize the amount of biodegradation that occurs for the chlorinated benzenes. So the concept we developed is what we call a reactive barrier. Rather than trying to treat the entire groundwater plume, what we're proposing is a sort of a biomat near the exit point, which would basically cover the groundwater as it exits the ground. And we would develop matrices that contain sand, and they contain an inocula for bioaugmentation. We have activated carbon for sorption, and then we can add electron donors to provide the carbon source to help drive the reactions like chitin, peat, or mulch. The benefits of using a biobarrier or reactive barrier is its low capital cost compared to alternatives. We don't need to do as much digging and removal of material. It's low maintenance once it's in place. We have minimal disturbance below the surface layer, and we have both sequestration and degradation potential that's occurring. Why this is important is that these coordinated benzenes, if you look historically, we know that there's been literature on degradation pathways, and in the absence of oxygen under anaerobic conditions, we know that the chlorinated compounds can react by reductive dechlorination. This occurs when there's an external electron donor, a substrate here like shown here on the left, or a simple substrate, organic acids like lactate. And what happens is that this facilitates the reductive dechlorination, but we generally find that we can take off a few chlorines, but it usually stalls at monochlorobenzene in the case of the chlorinated benzenes. And then aerobically, the reverse happens. That is, when you have many halogens, those compounds tend to be not very degradable. Aerobically, they might even be totally recalcitrant. But when you have the lower chlorinated analogs like chlorobenzene and even benzene, these are readily degradable aerobically by a number of different chlorinated benzene oxidizers, and we can achieve complete mineralization with that system. And so when you combine the two pathways, anaerobic pathways to do reductive dechlorination, take off some halogens, and then you get products that are more amenable to aerobic degradation, this really is the hypothesis that we're pursuing by having this dual biofilm barrier, having both the anaerobic and aerobic zones. So we know that in these subsurface sites that we do get redox gradients. Here's sort of a classical picture where you might have a lot of different electron acceptors available, ranging from oxygen, nitrate, manganese, iron, sulfate, and carbon dioxide. And so you can get a lot of different redox regimes that are present. We're mainly focusing on the aerobic side on the right, and then the inner core, we have methanogenesis sulfate reduction because there's a lot of sulfate at this site. So if you look at this site, we do find a lot of dissolved organic carbon, somewhere between 14 and 56 milligram per liter, and there's a lot of sulfate present, anywhere from 0.42 to 1,000 milligram per liter. The sulfate is believed to come from sulfuric acid that has been spilled at the site along with the chlorinated benzenes. So the research questions we're trying to ask in this project are that what is the potential for chlorobenzene biodegradation at these anaerobic-aerobic interfaces, and then how do the natural geochemical conditions affect the dynamics of the degradation processes, particularly the electron donor availability and the alternative electron acceptor availability. Just mentioned that we have this range between anaerobic and aerobic conditions. So here's what we've been doing. On the left-hand side, that's the picture I showed you before. So our conceptual model is that we have anaerobic groundwater with the chlorinated benzenes present, going upward and entering the estuary and the creek, and then we have surface oxygenation that create the aerobic zone. In the laboratory, we simulated this using a column system shown on the right-hand side, which was packed with either sand or sand and sediment from the site, and we created an anaerobic zone by putting in an electron donor, in this case sodium lactate, along with our feed trichlorobenzene as the main inlet to the column. And then there was a side stream of oxygenated water that was entered two-thirds up the column to create the aerobic zone. So in the laboratory, we were able to create this anaerobic-aerobic zone in one column. We used a fine medium in the laboratory, sodium lactate as a donor, and we had a constant flow system, so we have more control on the reactions to be able to show proof of concept of our methodology. Here shows some of the pictures in the laboratory. We use two columns in parallel, a filter sand by itself, and then some site sediment and filter sand to better mimic what was happening in the field. We did bioaugment the zones. The anaerobic zone was bioaugmented with a culture called WBC2. This had previously been used by USGS and some of their other field studies. And then we have an enrichment of aerobic degraders from the site in Delaware from one of the wells that was used for the aerobic zone. And then we have a series of these columns so we could test different conditions and flow regimes. So in terms of proof of concept, we operated columns for a long time, over 300 days, in basically to mimic what was happening in the field, where the main variable that we studied was the amount of sodium lactate we added to study the range of effect of dissolved organic carbon. And so we had a low dose of 15 milligrams per liter, a medium dose of 31, and a very high dose of 155 milligrams per liter sodium lactate. And that feed is shown in the upper bar graph, showing it kind of the feed levels as phases for this sodium lactate. And then what we did is we monitored basically the chlorinated benzene concentrations coming out of the effluent, and also looked for degradation under aerobic conditions of the chlorinated benzenes as well. So we have two plots, in the middle and the bottom plot. The top plot represents the amount of basically dechlorination that occurred. So trichlorobenzene would have three chlorines, and if it was dechlorinated, it would go to two and then one. So one would show good dechlorination. And then on the bottom plot, the more aerobic degradation we have, the more destruction and mineralization we saw was the compounds. So in looking what occurred, basically depending on the electron donor that was added, the concentration level would impact the amount of dechlorination that would occur and would also impact the amount of mineralization that would occur. In the lower left, we had a profile on the column. So this is looking along the column length. And so in the sediment sand, the pink area, reddish area in the lower left is showing you the 1,2,4 trichlorobenzene, showing that it was very effectively, reductively dechlorinated in that sediment sand system. The sand alone was not quite as effective, but nevertheless, we did get eventually all the trichlorobenzene essentially transformed to either the dichlorobenzene or monochlorobenzene. And then on the right-hand side, the loss of chlorobenzene there shows the amount of aerobic biodegradation that occurred. So we were pleased, at least with these column systems, that we were able to see and test our hypothesis, and we saw good dechlorination along with aerobic oxidation in these lab-scale columns. Just to show the influence of the electron donor, then that happened, here's a little plot to show what was occurring. As we increase the sodium lactate going from left to right, we have the two columns on the bar graph on the left is the dechlorination that occurred, and we have the bar graph on the right, which shows the amount of aerobic degradation. And basically, looking at the sand sediment column, as we increase the amount of sodium lactate, we then saw greater reductive dechlorination, and essentially it leveled off. We were getting complete reductive dechlorination of the trichlorobenzene in that anaerobic zone. And then when you looked at the aerobic zone, we would see that with the sand sediment, we would have persistence of some of the compounds because the oxygen was being consumed with some of the sodium lactate, particularly the high-dose sodium lactate. And then in the sand system, we had a little less removal there. In terms of degradation, the same thing occurred. We find that when you add sodium lactate, that the low doses, we had very effective aerobic oxidation of the chlorobenzene. But at the higher doses, what we think's happening is that now you have more sodium lactate, and that's being preferentially used with the oxygen, and there's no oxygen really left over to oxidize the chlorobenzene. So basically, the message is that too much organic donor will shut down the reaction. And so we focus more, at least our recommendation at this point, would be the lower doses of the sodium lactate would help facilitate this aerobic oxidation. We also looked at some of the microbial community profiles in the system. So this is done through 16S RNA sequencing. And on the left was the sand sediment column, and on the right is the sand column. And so particularly in the sand sediment column, we were quite encouraged that one of the predominant organisms that is known to dechlorinate compounds is Dehalobacter. So that's in green, shown on the left-hand side. So in the anaerobic zone, we had the enrichment of Dehalobacter in the sediment column, where we only saw a very thin slice in the sand column. And then when you oxygenate the system, you get another shift in the bacteria. These are more what we call aerobic generalists. We don't really know the specific role, but these are organisms like Pseudomonas and Comonomonas that are able to degrade a broad spectrum of organic compounds. Looking at the community profiles a little more, separating them out, these represent column length. The position on the x-axis, this is a column length from start left end anaerobic to the aerobic on the right side. Here again, we see the Dehalobacter profile, at least in the sediment column, shows a very good enrichment in the initial part where it's anaerobic. The concentrations were much lower, at least two orders of magnitude lower for Dehalobacter in the aerobic sand column, or the sand column alone. We also found some sulfate reducers and methanogens in the sediment. And then in terms of the oxidizers in the aerobic zone, there are a number of species that accumulated as well in that aerobic zone, but we haven't confirmed their role in the chlorobenzene oxidation. And then one of the final experiments we've just been wrapping up is to look at the influence of electron acceptor dose. We know that at the site there's, for example, elevated sulfate, and potentially there could be some elevated nitrate with agricultural influences in the area. And so we did some column studies to compare the addition of sulfate and nitrate to the unamended, to the net, what we call the standard conditions, which is what I just showed you previously, and then we had an abiotic control to eliminate biodegradation totally. We operated these systems in four phases, where we basically ramped up the nitrate and sulfate, trying to achieve levels that would be comparable to either drinking water standards or very elevated contamination in groundwater, and the sulfate particularly was mimicking the levels we found at the site. So we had the same column design. We just, in addition to adding oxygen, added these nitrate and sulfate as electron acceptors. And what we found, basically, is that looking at these different phases, so there's two plots, again, looking at dechlorination reactions and aerobic degradation, is that when we added nitrate and sulfate, we tended to get less reductive dechlorination occurring with that. So these electron acceptors were then making the environment not as conducive for the trichlorobenzene to accept the electrons. And then in the case of nitrate, we saw that the aerobic degradation increased for the compounds, whereas the sulfate decreased the amount of aerobic degradation that occurred. And the explanation for that data are in the next few slides. So here we're showing basically a pie chart showing the breakdown of how the electron acceptors were used in the systems for anaerobic reduction, and then the next will show the aerobic. So we varied the nitrate from 0 millimolar to 2.5 millimolar. And in all cases, we find a very small fraction of the electron donor used for the chlorobenzene dechlorination. That's shown by the small percentages, 0.4, 0.3, 0.1, even 0% at the high dose. And so what happens is a very small fraction gets used for the reductive dechlorination. A lot of the electron donation and acceptor gets used for things like acetate fermentation, nitrate reduction, and sulfate reduction. And then we look at the aerobic side, we sort of see a similar picture, but what we think here is that we're seeing an enhancement of chlorobenzene oxidation, and what we think is occurring here is that the nitrate is basically using up some of these other electron donors like the excess lactate, sodium lactate in the system, and organic acids, and basically freeing up the oxygen to react with the chlorinated benzenes. And so we see that in the right-hand pie, that in this case, then, there's a lot more of the chlorobenzene oxidized with the oxygen that's in the system. With sulfate, sort of a similar picture in the anaerobic zone. Again, we see very little use for the actual reductive dechlorination. But what happens is you get sulfate reduction in there, and this will use up some of the lactate and other electron donors that's present. And then on the aerobic side, we know that the sulfide generated from a sulfate reduction, that can be reoxidized back to sulfide, and that consumes oxygen. So the reason that the sulfate is shutting down some of the aerobic reactions, we believe, is because now you get sulfide being reoxidized back to sulfate, which consumes the oxygen and retards the aerobic reactions. So to summarize in the key points of our laboratory studies, we see that we have both this anaerobic and aerobic pathway. So we did find reductive dechlorination of the trichlorobenzene to monochlorobenzene, and that can be oxidized to carbon dioxide. We also saw instances where trichlorobenzene could also be oxidized with the oxygen to CO2 in the presence of the system that we were studying. The other aspect is when we added this organic carbon, like the sodium lactate, what this did was promote reductive dechlorination. So we did see the trichlorobenzene going to chlorobenzene, a greater amount of that. But it would also consume the oxygen, which would then retard some of the degradation in the aerobic reactions. And then when we added sulfate, what happens there is the sulfate gets reduced by sulfate reduction to sulfide, and then that sulfide can be reoxidized back to sulfate, which will consume the oxygen and also tend to retard the aerobic reactions. And then finally, the nitrate, when you add that in the system, the nitrate did shut down some of the reductive dechlorination, meaning that the trichlorobenzene would accumulate, but it also removed some of the organic matter that was consuming oxygen and allowed more oxygen to be used for oxidation of the compounds. And then in a few minutes remaining in my talk, I just want to say that in conjunction with USGS and Michelle Laura, we were able to conduct a pilot study in the field to sort of do another proof of concept of what we're doing. So based on some of the laboratory measurements, this gave us some ideas on some of the conditions to use in the field. And then this is funded through EPA. This is Region 3 that is managing this site, and the staff at USGS primarily conducted these field tests. And basically what was done is there were these test plots that were 1 meter squared, and this was mixed in that we had reactive zones that had activated carbon and the bacteria cultures that we use in the laboratory. And then there were control sites adjacent to this. And then this was intended to capture the groundwater flow, which would contain the chlorobenzene contaminants. And basically looking at the sediment contaminant mass, the control is on the left in each of these two plots, and then the reactive zone is on the right. And what was found that it was operated for more than a year, up to 456 days, is that the amount of chlorobenzene mass in the reactive zones stayed fairly constant and actually ends up being at a pretty low level. You'll see in the next slide compared to the amount of chlorobenzene that passed through the column. So here we're looking at in the thousands of milligrams were being sequestered in these systems, but it stayed fairly constant, so it was not accumulating, which is evidence that there was decrease in the chlorinated benzenes within the system. And in particular, if you look at this next slide, this is a mass balance to show that the total amount of chlorobenzene mass carried in the groundwater passing through these test plots is in the millions of milligrams. So before I was showing you thousands of milligrams that were actually in the sediment itself, but millions were being passed through, and we actually never detected any compound mass leaving the test plots. So within the test plots, we were seeing what we think is very strong evidence for biodegradation to be occurring. And then to help confirm that, USGS installed these what are called biotraps. These are from Microbial Insights. And what they do is they're basically installed at a few centimeters below land surface. And what incorporated in here were some carbon-13 labeled monochlorobenzene. And then we could look at the fate of that monochlorobenzene, both in biomass and in carbon dioxide evolved in the site. And in the case of the biomass, we saw in the reactive zone, particularly at this site 135, a very elevated amount of this C13 in the biomass. So there was very strong evidence then that the chlorobenzene was being oxidized or degraded at least and being converted in part to biomass. And then finally, USGS did some measuring of some of the functional genes at the site and basically found that this also agreed with a higher abundance of aerobic oxidizers in some of the functional genes. And then the last data set deals with monochlorobenzene in terms of carbon dioxide. And so at both the reactive zones in these two test plots, there was very elevated the CO2 carbon dioxide with the C13 label. So this is the best evidence that we're actually getting oxidation of those contaminants. And in fact, there was no chlorobenzenes exiting the test plots themselves. So this basically shows that the laboratory studies, we documented that we could see degradation in this dual biofilm barrier, and then the test plots in the field are really confirming what we've seen in the laboratory and really give us confidence of applying this for a field application. So with that, I'm going to conclude. I do want to acknowledge Stephen Chow is a doctoral student. He's wrapping up his studies, hopes to graduate sort of end of summer, early fall with his PhD. And then here is my contact information, and then Michelle Laura, particularly at the USGS. And then we want to acknowledge the funding to the NIH EAH program here, and then a number of students and faculty have helped out with this as well. So with that, I'll conclude, and I think we have a Q&A session coming up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ed. Yes, indeed, we do have a Q&A session coming up, and we had a number of questions come through online. So I'm going to go ahead and go through those questions, and those of you out there, if you have not submitted a question yet, feel free to use the Q&A box. And after I go through these questions, I will open the phone lines for those who may want to ask a question on the phone. So Ed, the question came with regard to translating your lab work to the field, asking how would you optimize TCB and MCB biodegradation in the field where you would probably not use a soluble electron donor?
Right. Okay. So the plan would be, and that's what was done in the field pilot testing, is to use a less soluble substrate like chitin, and so the USGS has already studied that, and so that would be one way that would dissolve slowly so that you could put that into the test or put it into the matrix and then allow a substrate to be there for months or longer at a time. So really you'd want to look for basically solid substrates that would dissolve very slowly.
Great, thank you. This is also with regard to the column study. Why do you think more dehalicobacter was present in the sediment and sand column than in the sand only?
Well, we can only surmise that one benefit of the sediment, it's a much higher surface area to volume ratio, much finer material. So we didn't pack a column completely with sediment because that would be hard to have water flow through it. But the higher surface area to volume will allow for a greater accumulation of biomass. The other thing that probably is happening is that the sediment contains more micro niches. The sand is a cleaner system, and so it allows a greater colonization of organisms in the sediment itself.
Okay. And is there anything in particular to dehalicobacter that they prefer one matrix or the other, or you think it's more these other properties of the matrix themselves?
Yeah, I think it's more the other properties. Now, it could be that I know that some studies at USGS had looked at some of these organisms do require attachment. So if you try to work with them in suspended growth systems, they don't work very well. And so it could be the sand doesn't have enough surface area. And so that's probably a contributing factor.
Yeah. Okay, great. Thank you. Another question was, what was the TDS of the waters?
Oh, I have no idea, to be honest with you. But I know in terms of the groundwater, we know it's sort of, if sulfate's up to 1,000 milligram per liter, we're looking at those kinds of numbers, you know, 1,000 milligram per liter, a couple thousand. Certainly when it gets into the estuary, then you're talking 10,000 or higher. But it's an upwelling system or up hydraulic gradient. So the groundwater is passing through the barrier. And so in that case, it would be in the hundreds to thousands of milligram per liter.
Okay. Thank you. And have you seen any toxicity effect from the sulfide to the microbial population?
We did not. We also were a little bit surprised that the chlorine and benzene at this site, I didn't emphasize that, but we're looking at milligrams per liter. So typically at chlorinated solvent sites, usually it's microgram per liter or tens or hundreds of them. But here it's 5 to 10, even 50 milligram per liter of some of the DNAPL or some of the chlorinated benzenes that were present. So we thought maybe those might be toxic, but we didn't see any of that. And at least in the laboratory columns, we didn't see any sulfide toxicity at the levels that we were working with.
Okay. And what were those levels again?
Well, they ranged between about 0 and about up to 1,000 milligram per liter of sulfate. And, of course, that gets reduced to sulfide. So I guess I haven't done the mass balance in my head right now, but you're looking at 100 milligram per liter at most, but the lower doses would be a lot less. So we ramped it up, which also allows for acclimation if there was some toxicity effects.
Okay, great. And what was the geology of the sediment? for example, sand, clay, etc.?
Oh, boy. I didn't actually collect those. Stephen Chow, the student, worked with USGS to get the samples, so I couldn't tell you what that is.
Okay. We can follow up.
Yeah, we can if we need to.
About that one. Okay, great. And have you measured ORP and DO throughout the column?
We did.
What were those numbers?
We tried. We bought some systems that were supposed to do that, but it didn't work very well. So we mainly did the, based on the electron acceptors and donors, we could tell the anaerobic zone what it was like. And then we did the effluent to see what oxygen was left. And so in some cases, we would have some residual oxygen. In other cases, we would not, because of the way our column design was, if you had a high dose of the lactate, you would just overwhelm the amount of oxygen that we were adding. So we did monitor it in the effluent, but we weren't able to get profiles along the length of the column.
Okay. Thanks. And we did have clarification that the composition, the geology of the sediments is that they were sand.
Okay.
That's from Michelle Laura. Thank you, Michelle. And just to add to that, sand with wetland sediment that was silty clay and sand mix overlaying in the wetland.
Right. So it wouldn't be just sand by itself, but that definitely had fine material in it, and that would have some organic matter as well. So.
Okay, thanks. And what we'll do now is give folks on the phones a chance to ask a question if they'd like to. If you'd like to do that, you need to press #6, state your name and organization, and then you can ask your question. So we'll give people a couple minutes to do that. Again, that's #6. Okay, I'm not hearing anything. So, how generalizable are the results from this specific site, the Delaware site, to other sites?
Well, we definitely think this notion of chlorinated solvents being reductively dechlorinated and then going to be oxidized can apply to other classes of chemicals as well. Certainly, chlorinated solvents like trichloroethylene has been shown to sort of have similar behavior, or perchloroethylene or tetrachloroethylene, as it's called. PCBs, we know that those are also amenable to this kind of two-step approach where you have reductive dechlorination first and then oxidation. That's being used for a lot of sediment sites. So there are obviously going to be site-specific conditions which will alter exactly how you carry this out, but we do feel like the overall strategy has a lot of merit at a lot of sites where you can put this passive system and save some money and not have it be as costly as a complete remediation.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Ed, and your team, Stephen, Michelle, Neil, and Amar, for all of their work over the years. Again, just to emphasize, it was really wonderful to see such a great academic government and consulting partnership there. So really appreciate all the work you've done over the years on this project. And with that, I think we'll move on to our next speaker. Dr. Frank Loeffler. He is the Governor's Chair Professor in the Department of Microbiology in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of Tennessee. His lab focuses on discovering microorganisms and processes to clean the environment, counter damage done to ecosystems by human activity, and improve environmental health. He studies how naturally occurring bacteria break down pollutants like chlorinated solvents, radioactive wastes, and greenhouse gases. He has a BS in Agricultural Sciences and Biology and an MS in Microbiology from the University of Hohenheim in Germany, and a PhD in Technical Biochemistry and Microbiology from the Technical Institute of Hamburg, University of Hohenheim, and a completed postdoc in Microbial Ecology at Michigan State University. So, Frank, I will now turn it over to you.
Well, Heather, thank you very much for the introduction. So I'm going to talk about this project that we entitled Biogeochemical Controls over Organohalite Respiring Chloroflexi. And my Co-performers on this project were Sean Campagna, a professor in chemistry at the University of Tennessee, and Dr. Jun Yan, who was at the time a research assistant professor in microbiology. He now moved on to be a professor at the Chinese Academy of Sciences. So just to restate the problem, we already heard about it. There are many contaminated sites, Superfund sites in the U.S. There are about nearly 4,000 sites called under the Research Conservation and Recovery Act, and there are many brownfield sites. And what it basically means is that about 166 million people live within 3 miles of a Superfund or another contaminated site. That means about 53% of the population, including more than half of all children under the age of 5. And in Europe, the situation is similar. You have a large number of contaminated sites, about 100. A large number of contaminated sites and potentially contaminated sites. And a major point here is that many of these sites are contaminated or impacted with chlorinated compounds, particularly chlorinated solvents. So the main contaminants may be something else, but many also have chlorinated compounds and chlorinated solvents as major contaminants or co-contaminants. And so one of the major groups of contaminants in this are chlorinated ethenes, and you see on this slide tetrachloroethene on the left, then trichloroethene, dichloroethene, vinyl chloride, and ultimately on the right side, ethene, and that's a non-toxic compound. All the other chlorinated compounds are toxic and of environmental and human health concern. So in order to get this pathway going, this reductive dechlorination pathway, you need an electron donor, symbolized here. So every step, every reductive dechlorination step consumes electrons. And this is important for the microbiology, microbes that have specialized systems can capture the energy that is released in reductive dechlorination reactions. And organisms that have this capability, we call organisms that can perform organohalide respiration. But that's very important. These organisms benefit from reductive dechlorination reactions, so they grow. And so I just want to introduce a few of these organisms. So in this reductive dechlorination from PCE, the cis dichloroethene, there are different types of organisms involved. The picture here shows a Geobacter species, Geobacter lovelii, but they stop at cis dichloroethene. To achieve complete reductive dechlorination to a non-toxic product, so in this case, ethene, right, ethene here, this has been limited to organisms that belong to this group D. helicocoides, specifically the species D. helicocoides mccartii. And I just want to point out, so now let me see if I can use this pointer here. So here are these D. helicocoides strains. And I want to point out that a group that is related to D. helicocoides called D. halogenimonas, and those organisms have not been implicated in reductive dechlorination of chlorinated ethene. And so what we have done in this project, so we have demonstrated that the D. halogenimonas strain, we call D. halogenimonas ethiniformans, can in fact grow with TCE, dichloroethenes, and vinyl chloride and produce ethene. We then worked with Microbial Insights and looked in their database. They have an extensive database of groundwater samples where they perform qPCR. And in about 1,200 groundwater samples from 111 sites, 850 of these samples contained 16S rRNA genes of the halogenimonas and the helicocoides. And surprisingly to us, at 65%, the halogenimonas was actually more abundant than the helicocoides. Those samples were predominantly from sites impacted with chlorinated ethenes, and that kind of confirms our finding that dehalogenimonas species are important for reductive dechlorination of chlorinated ethenes. So it's not just the helicocoides. Okay, so in this reductive dechlorination process, the enzymes doing this, these reductive dehalogenases, they share a unique property. They're all carinoid dependent. And this is illustrated in this slide. So this is a dimer of a tetrachloroethane reductive dehalogenase. And you see here embedded, let me see if I can do this with this. Okay, so here embedded in this enzyme system is a carinoid cofactor. And this is critically important for reductive dechlorination. But the key point here is that all reductive dehalogenases contain carinoid cofactors. If you want to learn more about the details about the biochemistry and also the application and bioremediation of these organohalide respiring bacteria, I recommend this book, not because I edited it, but because the authors did a fantastic job putting chapters in there that are very informative about this process. Now coming back to the carinoid, so this is a general structure for carinoid, the central cobalt atom, and then you see on the bottom is something we call a lower base, highlighted here. In this case, it's dimethylbenzimidazole. And then up there is another ligand called R. It can carry different structures like 5-deoxyadenosyl, then it's adenosyl cobalamin, and other head groups. So I want to point your attention to this lower base. So there are 16 lower bases that have been identified in naturally occurring carinoids, and they are shown here. And they have received relatively little attention in terms of what is their influence on activity of enzymes that have a carinoid prosthetic group. And before I move on, I just want to highlight one finding we had. We identified a 17th lower base that's naturally occurring and plays a role in reductive dechlorination in some organisms, and that's unsubstituted purine, okay, as a new nucleo base in naturally occurring carinoids. But this is of interest also because this is the first function for unsubstituted purine in any biological system. When you think about carinoid, most organisms need this, including most bacteria, most archaea, for their metabolism, but only a fraction of them can actually produce carinoid. In case of bacteria, about 1/3 can make carinoid, okay, and 2/3 are carinoid auxotrophs. So they have incomplete or missing biosynthesis pathways, and they need to get the carinoid from organisms that can produce it. So this is in here shown by these arrows. So we need, these organisms depend on the carinoid producers. And an example, note the helicocoides cannot produce carinoid, even though its metabolism is strictly dependent on this molecule. But Geobacter lovelii, for example, can produce this molecule. So we, just to emphasize this point, so this is the helicocoides strain BAF1. When you grow this without carinoid, it cannot dechlorinate. When you have a limited amount of carinoid, you see some reductive dechlorination, but it stalls at the level of vinyl chloride. So you don't have complete detoxification, which you only achieve when you add sufficient carinoid. Okay? Then you get complete dechlorination to non-toxic ethene. But this is why this is so important to understand how this works. And this then brings me to specific aims we have in our work. So we wanted to demonstrate the specific carbamide requirements of the helicocoides and how this relates to chlorinated ethene detoxification. We wanted to explore how the geochemical environment in a natural system affects the carbamide pool and the helicocoides activity. And we wanted to develop tools that we can use to assess how carinoid limitations impact the helicocoides reductive dechlorination activity. I'll show you a few results of these activities. So this is a dehelicocoides cell, and I just want to briefly illustrate how this works. When they use hydrogen as electron donor, This hydrogen is being oxidized. The electrons are transferred to the chlorinated compound. This is associated with proton transport across a membrane. Then you have an influx of protons coupled to ATP synthesis. And this reductive dechlorination is catalyzed by this green reductive dehalogenase, which is strictly dependent on corinoid. Okay, and this corinoid in the helicocoides must be supplied by somebody else because the helicocoides can't make it. In contrast, Geobacter lovelii can dechlorinate PC to cis-DC, and this organism can make its own corinoid. So we performed, this is again illustrated here, co-culture studies where we tested if Geobacter lovelii can supply corinoid to corinoid auxotrophic dehelicocoides. So this is a schematic outline of these co-culture experiments. So we used the corinoid-producing organism and corinoid auxotrophic dehelicocoides McCartii, mixed them together, and then asked the question, do we see reductive dechlorination activity? This summarizes the findings of these co-culture experiments. So with Geobacter lovelii, yes, we did see reductive dechlorination activity in dehelicocoides. But then we tested a number of other organisms that we know produce corinoid, but they could not support the helicocoides growth. So this was a little puzzling to us. We didn't know what was going on, and then had the idea of adding dimethylbenzimidazole, remember this lower base of this corinoid, to these inactive cultures, and they all became active. So they all started dechlorinating, suggesting that these organisms produced the corinoid, but it was not suitable for the helicocoides to use it. But when we added DMB, the helicocoides was able to modify these corinoids and use it for dechlorination activity. We also did some additional experiments with Geobacter sulfur reducens, which could not, the wild type could not support the helicocoides growth. But we identified a gene on the gene of Geobacter lovelii that we believe performed the critical step in lower base biosynthesis. We cloned this gene into sulfur reducens, okay? And now sulfur reducens didn't produce this lower base. It produced this lower base here, 5-methoxybenzimidazole. And this, the corinoid with this lower base here, was able to support the helicocoides. So we modified the biosynthesis pathway of a naturally occurring microbe that now produced a different type of carbamide that had the ability to support the helicocoides dechlorination activity. Here you see the key reductive dehalogenases, or some of them involved in reductive dechlorination of chlorinated ethenes to non-toxic ethene. And the dashed arrows indicate that a specific enzyme is not present in these different strains, but the organism can co-metabolize these compounds if a growth-supporting chlorinated ethene is present. So here, these are the enzymes that catalyze these different steps. So keep in mind that different strains have different capabilities because they have different genes and express different enzymes. And so now we use strain BAF1 capable of cis-DC dechlorination to ethene. And you see if we add a corinoid, a carbamide with DMB as the lower base, we see complete conversion of cis-DCE to vinyl chloride and then to ethene, and we see high dechlorination rate. If you use the same culture under the same conditions, but we add a carbamide that carries this lower base, but the only difference is that these two methyl groups are lacking. The dechlorination activity was very different, okay? Very slow dechlorination. The end product was the same, but the rates were much slower. We did similar experiments with another dehelicocoid strain we had available, strain GT. Same story with dimethylbenzimidazole, high dechlorination rates, but with the other carbamide, we never saw really good ethene production. Okay, so this organism with the wrong carbamide is basically a vinyl chloride producer. But this emphasizes the critical role of these carbamides and their lower bases when it comes to reductive dechlorination activity. Okay, so the lower base affects dechlorination rates and endpoints. Okay, so we then ask the question, what influences the corinoid pool, which is obviously important to predict reductive dechlorination activity at contaminated sites? So there are two sites, the Surt Creek site in Knoxville, Tennessee, and a Superfund site in Vermont. We collected sediment material from one site and groundwater and cores from the other, and we established microcosms and transfer cultures under different redox conditions, okay, so fermenting, nitrate-reducing, ion-reducing, sulfate-reducing, methanogenic. And then asked the question, what type of corinoids are produced under these different redox conditions? And this table summarizes the results. We are still analyzing this. These are difficult experiments, not easy to do, but we are still analyzing. I just want to point out that these carbamides support the helicocoides activity. These do okay, but not so great, and these do not support the helicocoides activity. And you can see that under certain redox conditions, we do see the good carbamides produced that support the helicocoides activity, but then there are also redox conditions where others that do not support the helicocoides are produced. And now this is obviously important in order to predict and manage sites efficiently to get the best possible reductive dechlorination activity occurring. We also looked at the quantity of these different carbamides produced, and there were significant differences. So for example, under ion-reducing conditions, we always saw low amounts of corinoid produced. Okay? And then you see here that different, again, what I showed in the previous slide, that different redox conditions, you see different types of carbamides produced. So this summarizes what I just tried to explain to you. First, the amount of carbamide being present for the helicocoides influences the outcome of reductive dechlorination. But it's not just the amount, it's also the type, the quality of the corinoid that's being produced. If methanogens produce a lot of corinoid with the wrong lower base that does not support the helicocoides, you will not see a lot of reductive dechlorination activity. So now another aspect of corinoid chemistry, I just want to mention this because I think this is important. So it has been established that this cobalt occurs in different oxidation states. And for reductive dechlorination, the cobalt 1 state is critically important for catalyzing carbon-chlorine bond cleavage. So what I show here, this is cobalt 3. You can easily see this visually, different absorption spectrum. You can reduce that to cobalt 1. But then this cobalt 1 state can be oxidized to cobalt 2, for example, by a common molecule like laughing gas, N2O. So this is not novel. This was known for a long time. Here I show what we know about nitrous oxide, N2O. So the current atmospheric concentration is about 330 parts per billion. So if this is, you know, there's no restriction, and this would dissolve in groundwater, you would predict that groundwater has a concentration of N2O of about 7 nanomolar, okay? So people actually measured the concentration and found that they are orders of magnitude higher. So up to 143 micromolar were reported. So there's quite a bit of N2O in groundwater. So now we ask the question, does this N2O impact corinoid-dependent reductive dechlorination? Now I'll show you the results of these studies. So we use Geobacter lovelii here as an example. We had increasing concentrations of nitrous oxide. Shown in these gray bars are the rates of dechlorination. Oh no, the percent of dechlorination of chloride released. The point is, when you add more nitrous oxide, the rates go down And the at 60 micromolar nitrous oxide, there was essentially no dechlorination. So this organism is inhibited by nitrous oxide when it grows with PCE as electron acceptor. So now you may wonder, maybe this organism is just sensitive to N2O. We did a control experiment where we grew the same organism with fumarate as electron acceptor. And we added even higher concentrations of N2O, and we saw zero impact of N2O on the organism. And this is because here, there are not really corynoid-dependent metabolic steps needed when the organism grows with fumarate. In contrast to reductive dechlorination, where the reductive dehalogenases are corynoid-dependent enzyme systems. So we did similar experiments with with P. helicocoides, and I summarized the results here. So this is a table from a paper that summarizes measurements of N2O concentrations in groundwater. We see here they can reach up to 140 micromolar. And these are the inhibitory constants we determined for different reductive dechlorination steps. And you can see that, for example, for this most sensitive step, vinyl chloride reductive dechlorination to ethene, about 10 micromolar of N2O would inhibit the transformation rate by 50%. So you would predict that N2O in these aquifers with higher concentrations of N2O is a significant modulator of reductive dechlorination activity and endpoints. And so we believe that this could be a possible explanation for observed 50C and vinyl chloride stalls at many sites. So this is the student who worked on this N2O inhibition, and this was a paper that was recently published in ESNT, illustrating that we should probably pay attention to nitrous oxide in groundwater as a potential inhibitor of this activity. But then the last aspect of our project was to look for potential biomarkers that would indicate if Dehalococcoides or Dehalogenomonas experience corynoid limitations in situ. So what I show here is complicated. It's the pathway of cobamide in microbial systems, in bacteria. And so many organisms, I told you this before, cannot do this. So they have to get their corynoid from other organisms. So they salvage corynoids from the environment, take them up, and then channel them into the last steps of biosynthesis. Now here in yellow, I highlighted all the genes and enzymes that Dehalococcoides possesses. So these are the steps Dehalococcoides can mediate. It cannot synthesize the corine ring system from scratch, but it has the capability of modifying corynoids it takes up from the environment. And those are obviously now good targets that we can monitor, so the expression of the gene, we may also be able to monitor the expression of the protein, and we can relate this information back to the question, are Dehalococcoides organisms experiencing corynoid limitations, and what we can potentially do about it. So to look at the genes and the transcripts, we have been working on now for a number of years on developing a high-throughput qPCR tool. So this is a unique system with an array plate that has 3,072 through holes, and in each hole you have a different, you have a specific primer probe set. So you can have a total of up to 224 different primer probe sets, and then you have a highly redundant tool, so you can run multiple samples in parallel. And if you run four of these plates in one run, what you can do, you can actually generate more than 12,000 qPCR data points in 2 hours. So this sounds fantastic, and this tool actually does work, but the development time was substantial. And it took us nearly 4 years to develop this plate, and are now finally in a position that we can analyze groundwater samples and then ask the question, are these genes there? Are they being expressed? And then we can tell people the status of their particular system in terms of coronoid availability to D-helicocoides. So just quickly, the take-home messages of what I attempted to explain to you. The coronoids are important for most organisms, in particular for organohalite-respiring bacteria that cannot make their own coronoid, like D-helicocoides and D-halogenemonas. We actually think that these are ideal systems to study the effects of coronoid limitations on metabolism, or the effects of different lower bases on metabolism. So the coronoid quantity, that means the flux, affects the chlorination activity. I showed you that. I also showed you that the lower base, or the type of lower base, has a strong impact on reductive dechlorination rates and endpoints. I also showed you that the geochemical conditions of the environment affect the coronoid pool and then obviously affect the activity of coronoid-dependent organisms like the helicocoides. Mentioned briefly that we identified purine as a novel lower base. And taken together, we believe that information about these lower bases and how different carbamides with different lower bases affect microbial metabolism has implications beyond just reductive dechlorination and the helicocoides. We can potentially influence the function and the ecology of microbiomes in different systems. So for example, the rumen microbiome, but it also has medical implications. So I think there's a lot more potential exploring the effects of these lower bases and the activity of coronoid-dependent enzyme systems that goes beyond bioremediation. So these are products from our work, a few of the papers that we have published. We still have papers in preparation, so hopefully we can extend this list this year. And then I have to thank a number of people. So in particular, Sean Campagna, who is a co-performer on this project in the chemistry department, and Dr. Jun Yan, who is now with the Chinese Academy of Sciences back in China. So I have a number of people who are still trying to finish papers and are working on this project. I have a number of people who have graduated and have left. I have to thank Microbial Insights for their help giving us access to samples. And then also the University of Toronto with Elizabeth Edwards' group. They helped us with certain analyses to identify unsubstituted purine as a novel lower base. And then, of course, I have to thank NIH for funding. And part of this work was also supported by CERDAP and ESTCP. With that, I'm finished and would be happy to answer questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Yeah, we had a number of questions come in, so I will waste no time and go right to the questions. Does D-halogenemonas have the same requirements for coronoids?
All the genomes that we have looked at suggest that D-halogenemonas cannot synthesize the corin ring. So yes, it appears they have the same coronoid limitation. That means they depend on other microbes to supply this cofactor. Now, it's possible, you know, when more genomes become available, maybe we find a D-halogenemonas or a D-helicocoides genome that actually does have this biosynthesis pathway. But so far, we have not seen that.
Okay. Thank you. And can coronoids be added to biostimulate?
So in the laboratory, sure, this works. So you can buy vitamin B12, which is cyanocobalamin, and this is a carbamide that supports the helicocoides dechlorination activity. So this can be easily achieved in the laboratory. I do not believe it's a very good approach in the field. Theoretically, cyanocobalamin would benefit the helicocoides and would meet its nutritional requirement for carinoid. But carinoid, think about this as a very expensive molecule. It's very difficult to make. Lots of energy is needed. So when organisms see carinoid, they take it up. Okay, it's a valuable commodity. They want to have it. And so we tested that, and we had microcosms established with these materials from these contaminated sites. We added carinoid, cyanocobalamin, vitamin B12, and it was very quickly taken out of the system. So within a day or two, the carinoid we added was gone. It was no longer detectable. So it's very quickly taken up by microbes, and this all happened before we saw any reductive dechlorination activity. So in other words, before the helicocoides wakes up, the carinoid that was added was already gone, taken up by others. To translate this into, you know, for practical point of view is, when you add expensive vitamin B12 to a field site, I do not believe the helicocoides will benefit from that, because other organisms consume or take it up before the helicocoides gets a chance.
Okay. That's insightful. Thank you. Another question came in. Can the new qPCR method detect the de novo carinoid synthesis pathways? I believe
So we have not designed assays to detect de novo biosynthesis. Our focus was on the genes that we find on the helicocoides genomes, because we specifically wanted to monitor the helicocoides responses to carinoid limitations. That was our goal. And since the helicocoides cannot de novo synthesize carinoid, the corin ring, we do not have this capability on the current design of this array plate. So we cannot do that. So this doesn't mean that we cannot modify the array plates to include de novo biosynthesis genes. The issue is that these array plates are, so each array plate is $1,000. And you have to buy at least 20 of them from the supplier. So basically, every new design, the investment would be $20,000, plus the time doing all the design work. So this sounds expensive, and it is. But once you have the system designed, you can run many, many, many samples. And then the cost per PCR reaction is cheaper compared to running individual PCR. But of course, you are kind of stuck with the design you have until all the chips are gone. So that's the disadvantage and advantage of this array plate system.
Great. And is that technology available? Like, how would somebody access that technology?
So to my understanding is that right now, I mean, the technology is available in the medical field, but that's easier because you know exactly what you're looking for. So now here we have a moving target, right? I think we are the only ones having a design to test reductive dechlorination in environmental samples, in groundwater samples. So our design includes all the reductive dehalogenase genes, and other genes that are indicators for dehelicocoides activity, including these carinoid modification-specific genes. So the only way to really access this technology would be through my lab. Our goal is to make this technology available with the entire primer design effort that has gone into this design and everything, so that anybody could purchase such array plates, or work with a company, you know, that adopts this technology. So this is certainly a vision I have for the next future. But right now, this is not commercially available at this level of this array plate design. It may be that many of these assays are available individually, but not necessarily as on an array plate. I hope I made this clear. So the big advantage is once this system is operating, you can run many samples in parallel. And if you do have, or a commercial entity has many samples, then the cost per PCR reaction will drop.
That makes sense. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, we do have a couple more questions. Maybe I'll just go for one right now, and then we can come back to the others if there's time at the end. But cobalt sulfide, that's extremely insoluble. Is there any evidence that this could be a limiting factor in high sulfate environments?
Cobalt, so if cobalt is limiting, was that the question? Cobalt?
Right. Well, yeah, because cobalt sulfide is extremely insoluble, have you ever noticed that cobalt becomes limiting in high sulfate environments?
No. So if you think about the total, you know, it's not that these cells are loaded with corioid. The helicocoides has a higher corioid requirement than many other organisms. But still, the number of corioid molecules per cell is not enormous. And I give you, so we tried to make cobalt-free medium in the laboratory because we wanted to test if cobalt can be a limiting factor for corioid biosynthesis or cobamide biosynthesis. And we completely failed. We were not able to eliminate all cobalt in the laboratory, even if we tried to precipitate everything with sulfide. So my takeaway from that is it's going to be very difficult to make cobalt the limiting factor for cobamide biosynthesis. And I also conclude from these experiments that in an environmental system, I do not believe that cobalt will ever be the limitation for biosynthesis of functional cobamide.
Okay. Good. That's valuable to know. As I mentioned, there were a couple of other questions, but we will hopefully get to them after our next speaker. We want to go ahead and move on. And thank you so much, Frank, for that presentation, and to Sean and Junyan also for their assistance in your work collaboration. I would like to now move on to our third speaker. Dr. Sean Yi is an assistant project scientist at the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at the University of California, Berkeley. Her research focuses on investigating microbial metabolism and syntrophic interactions and their impact on the performance of bioprocesses in environmental engineering, such as bioremediation of chlorinated solvents. She obtained her PhD in environmental engineering from Nanyang Technological University of Singapore and her baccalaureate in biochemical engineering from Tianjin University in China. She is going to be speaking on behalf of Lisa Alvarez-Cohen, who is the PI for this grant. And at this time, I will turn it over to Sean. And if you are on mute, we can't hear you. Maybe you can take your phone off mute by pressing #6. Maybe that's what the problem is.
All right. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, there you are.
All right.
Hi, Sean.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Heather. And thank you for this opportunity to allow us to share our research. So here I'm going to talk about our research on studying the metabolic interactions supporting effective TCE bioremediation on the biogeochemical conditions. All right. As Frank has introduced most of the background information, so here I just want to emphasize that anaerobic reductive dechlorination of a TCE or TCE is a stepwise process At each step, hydrogen serving as the electron donor is oxidized, and one chlorinated carbon is reduced, serving as the electron acceptor. Many environmental bacteria whose genus names are listed here can carry out this reductive dechlorination. But this bacteria can only remove one or two chlorine atoms, which generates even more toxic intermediates, such as dichloroethane and vinyl chloride. In contrast, the bacterium Dehalococcoides, or DHC in short, is the currently only known organism capable of completely detoxifying PCE and other chlorinated acid to benign compound ethane. DHC has a very unique requirements for growth. So, for example, it has to use organohalides as the electron acceptor, hydrogen as the electron donor, and only use acetate as a primary carbon source. As Frank mentioned in his talk, carinoid coenzymes are crucial to the dechlorination reactions of a DHC, which can synthesize this coenzyme. Also, in our previous study, we found that DHC generates toxic carbon monoxide as a byproduct from a unique biosynthesis of amino acid methionine. So what is shown here actually is a very fastidious lifestyle of a DHC. Therefore, it's quite amazing that in the microbial communities that are capable of efficient TCE dechlorination, all these requirements of a DHC can be met through forming symbiotic interactions with other microorganisms. Here is a conceptual model describing the metabolic interactions and the material exchange occurring in an anaerobic microbial community that can efficiently remediate TCE. This diagram is very, very busy and looks almost like a traditional chandelier light. The bottom line here is that there are many types of reciprocal interactions ongoing in the TCE dechlorinating community, where DHC obtains all needed energy, carbon source, coenzymes, and a removal of toxic waste from its coexisting bacteria. In the meanwhile, other community members can be benefit from the removing the toxicity of the chlorinated solvents and in a more energetically favorable condition by forming centrophic interactions with the DHC. At a bioremediation site, it's necessary to ensure that all the significant interactions and material exchange are occurring to achieve the final remediation outcome. So for example, sometimes organic carbon can be injected to encourage the microbial activities in producing hydrogen, acetate, and carinoid coenzymes. As the groundwater environment can be affected by geochemical parameters, it's very crucial to understand how these parameters impact the interactions and the material exchange supporting the TCE dechlorination. So in our study, we focus on the effects of sulfate reduction and salinity stress. To study the effects, we firstly simplified the complicated community by constructing microbial consortia containing a few bacterial strains representing the significant interactions important for TCE dechlorination. We then introduced the perturbed geochemical conditions, such as the interference of a sulfate reduction or salinity stress, to investigate how the TCE dechlorination and the interactions were affected. Transcriptomics analysis was also performed using either microarray or RNA-seq analysis to elucidate the cellular responses of a DHC to geochemical conditions. So from all this analysis, we also aimed to obtain insights into the possible engineering solution that can alleviate the perturbation caused by geochemical conditions. So now let's first look at the sulfate reduction effects on TCE dechlorination. Sulfate is commonly found in the groundwater environment. Under anaerobic conditions, sulfate-reducing bacteria couple hydrogen oxidation with a sulfate reduction to generate a sulfide. These bacteria often occur under the similar redox conditions as the DHZ. Prior to our research, there was a lack of a coherent understanding of how and why sulfate reduction affects TCE dechlorination processes. In our study, we focus on testing two hypotheses. So we use pure bacteria culture of three bacteria to examine the toxicity effects of a sulfate or sulfide, and then use a defined consortia of the three bacteria and a more complex enrichment culture to test the hydrogen computation under two scenarios. The one was an electron acceptor limitation, which means hydrogen was provided in excess of the amount that is needed for both TCE dechlorination and sulfide reduction. Electron donor limitation means that limited hydrogen was generated and insufficient for both reactions. So this table lists the three bacterial strains used in our analysis. Isopropyl, vulgaris, Hildenborough, or DBH in short, represents a fast fermenter that can quickly generate hydrogen to a relatively high concentration when using acetate as a substrate without the presence of a sulfate. So when sulfate is available, this bacteria uses as an internal electron acceptor to gain energy. Centrophomonas wuffii is also a fermenter, but only slowly release hydrogen by fermenting organic carbon such as the butyrate. Therefore, we use DBH and S-wuffii to form consortia with DHC-195 to investigate the impact of sulfate reduction on TCE dechlorination under these two limiting conditions. So let's first take a look at the results on the inhibitory analysis, which shows that sulfate concentration at 5 millimolar did not affect the cell growth or TCE dechlorination of DHC-185. Similarly, no toxic effects were observed on the other two bacteria tested here. However, at a 5 millimolar level, sulfide caused a decrease in cell yield for both DHC-185 and S-wuffii. Because DBH is a sulfate-reducing bacteria, it has a higher tolerance to sulfide and showed inhibition in cell growth only when sulfide concentration were more than 10 millimolar. Here is a more detailed view of the sulfide inhibition on DHC-185. We tested TCE dechlorination and cell growth on the two sulfide concentrations, 2 and 5 millimolar. So under both conditions, TCE dechlorination rates were decreased and the cell growth was inhibited. The transcriptomic analysis using microarray indicates that the gene involved in ATP synthesis and some metal-containing enzymes and a few biosynthesis pathways were differentially expressed under the sulfide inhibitory conditions, suggesting the sulfide toxicity might relate to the inhibition of a metal-containing enzymes involved in the energy metabolism. So let's turn to the test on the second hypothesis on the hydrogen competition between TCE dechlorination and sulfide reduction. We started a test using a co-culture of the DBH and the DHC-195. And our previous studies showed that these two bacteria can form stable consortium when sulfate is not available. Under this condition, the cell number of DHC-185 and DBH maintain a stable ratio of around 5:1. And DBH is also capable of using carbon monoxide generated from DHC. And in this study, we use this co-culture to simulate the sulfate reduction effects under electron acceptor limiting conditions, which means that a hydrogen was enough for both sulfate reduction and TCE dechlorination. The figures here show the results of a TCE dechlorination cell growth and a sulfate reduction respectively. In the presence of a 5 millimolar sulfate, we observed that TCE decarnation rate decreased about 60% from day 4 to day 9, and became stalled on day 9 and onward. Consistent with this decreased TCE decarnation, no DHC-195 growth were observed beyond day 4. And interestingly, the deviate to grow more cells and the ratio of DHC-195 to DVH became 1 to 6. And the amended sulfate was converted entirely to sulfide on day 4, which was coincident with observed decrease in TCE decarnation and cell growth. So this analysis indicates that the faster growth kinetics of a DVH under the electron acceptor limiting condition causes sulfide accumulation, which in turn inhibited the activities and the growth of DHC-195. For the electron limiting condition, triculture of S-Wu-Shui-I, DVH, and DHC-195 were used to construct a consortium with the amendment of sulfate, butyrate, and TCE. It's apparent here that there was no inhibition on TCE decarnation except for a brief lag phase due to the low initial hydrogen concentration. So here shows the cell, also here shows the cell growth during the initial consortium construct. And eventually, the ratio of DHC-195 DVH and the S-Wu-Fi stabilized at a ratio around 16 to 1 and 1. So the results here were actually due to the higher hydrogen affinity of the DHC compared to DVH, which enabled DHC to outcompete DVH and secured efficient TCE decarnation on the low hydrogen concentration. To further understand this interplay of sulfate reduction and TCE decarnation, methanogenic TCE decarnating enrichment was used to test the performance of a community under the two limiting conditions. Two sulfate concentrations at a 2 and 5 millimolar were amended in this experiment. And similar to what we observed in consortia, when hydrogen was abundant, TCE decarnation stalled on day 6 in both cultures. Further addition of acetate resumed the TCE decarnation in 2 millimolar sulfate culture, but not in the 5 millimolar sulfate amendment. And under electron donor limitation condition, we see that TCE decarnation rates were comparable between control and the two amended cultures. Only little sulfate reduction was observed. This analysis indicates that creating an electron donor limitation can be beneficial to TCE decarnation in the presence of a sulfate. So now let's switch gear to take a look at how salinity affects TCE decarnation. Here shows a map of TCE contamination at a national priority list site. And many of these sites are along the coast and can be affected by elevated salinity, such as during seawater intrusion. However, the effects of salinity on TCE bio remediation are currently unknown. In this study, we tested, we hypothesized that salt stress can affect TCE decarnation to impact the cellular metabolism and the function of a DHC or affect the microorganisms that form symbiotic interactions with the HSE. To test this hypothesis, we use a triculture consortium containing DHC-185-DVH and a strain called Pylocynus fermentans R7, or PFR7 in short. Pylocynus species were found in our previous analysis as the major coronoid generating bacteria in a dechlorinating groundwater enrichment culture. Similar to our previous approach, few cultures were used to study the responses of each strain to the soft stress. And this is a triculture consortium was used to investigate the salinity effect under two scenarios. One was to simulate the condition where elevated salinity is already present in a groundwater environment. And the other one was to simulate the salt perturbation when TCE dechlorination is already ongoing. This figure shows the interaction of these three strains in a triculture consortium, where both DVH and PFR7 ferment lactate. As we saw before, DVH generates hydrogen and acetate. PFR7 generates acetate and propionate as a fermentation product and also produce coronoids that can be used by DHC-185 when a lower ligand compound was also present. We started with investigating the salt stress on the pure culture of these three strains, and the cells used here were all in the mid-exponential growth phase. Our analysis indicates that PFR7 has a most sensitive, was most sensitive to elevated salinity. Okay. Get this arrow to work. Oh. All right. So the growth of PFR7 was we found was inhibited at a concentration ranging from 220 to 400 millimolar. When glycine B10 was added as an osmoprotectant, we see the growth of a PFR7 was partially restored at a salt concentration from 300 to 400 millimolar. As DVH was the sole source of hydrogen in this consortium, we examined the hydrogen production under different salt concentrations. So here shows the hydrogen production was inhibited by salt concentration ranging from 300 to 450 millimolar. When GB was added, the severe inhibition at a near 450 millimolar was elevated, and hydrogen production increased from 13 to 80% of the amount observed in control experiments. And then our analysis demonstrated that DHC-185 actually had the highest tolerance to salinity among all three cultures tested. In the salt concentration near seawater, as pointed here, DHC still had a TCE dechlorination activity. However, at this concentration, severe inhibition on cell growth was found, as shown here. Common osmoprotectant used by other mesophytic bacteria, such as ethylene, proline, and glycine B10, did not relieve the soft stress by DHC-185. And the RNA-seq analysis shows the differential expression of genes involved in both biosynthesis and energy metabolism, and it indicates an overall slowdown in both of this processes. The transcriptomic analysis also indicates that the cellular functions were regulated towards the mechanisms to cope with the stress rather than to the cell reproduction. So with the understanding of a pure culture's response to salt stress, We then move on to investigate how salt stress affects the interactions supporting the TCE decoronation consortium. Different salt concentrations were introduced during the first dose of a TCE. We used this condition to simulate the groundwater sites where salinity is already increased to investigate how TCE decoronation is affected. And our analysis showed a significant inhibition on the consortium at a concentration around 270 millimolar and higher. The amendment of the GB slightly enhanced the salt tolerance at a concentration around 350 millimolar. So as our pupil culture results have shown, salt stress had a more significant impact on PFR7's growth. Therefore, the inhibition observed was mostly due to lack of crinoids that resulted from the decreased growth of a PFR7. In the experiment simulating salinity perturbation, the triculture firstly performed TCE decoronation without salt stress during first dose of a TCE. And at onset of a second TCE dose, salinity stress at a concentration ranging from 300 to 450 millimolar was then introduced. As we expected, inhibitory effects caused by these concentrations, GB was also amended to investigate to what extent GB can help the consortium overcome the salt stress. The figure here shows that amendment of GB significantly recovered the decoronation rate at a concentration around 350 millimolar, but it was not as effective for the concentration around 400 millimolar. Aqueous hydrogen concentration was confirmed not to be the limiting factor in this experiment, suggesting that inhibited growth of a PFR7 and a limited crinoids again were the main reason of the inhibition observed here. Therefore, in the next set of our experiments, vitamin B12 was added together with the GB at the beginning of the second dose of TCE. So our results showed here that this amendment fully recovered decoronation rates at a concentration around 350 millimolar, and it significantly improved the decoronation at a concentration around 400 millimolar. However, no significant improvement could be achieved at a salt concentration of a near 450 millimolar and higher. To summarize, so our analysis on the sulfate reduction effects shows that sulfite was inhibitory to both DHC and is a symbiotic bacteria. At a condition where hydrogen was abundant, the fast kinetics of sulfate-reducing bacteria generated a sulfite that inhibited TCE decoronation. So to prevent such an inhibition from sulfite, using slowly fermentable substrate can take advantage of a high hydrogen affinity of a DHC and help TCE decoronation outcompete sulfate reduction. And for the salt stress, we see that DHC 185 had a relatively higher tolerance compared to its coexisting bacteria. The salt stress mostly caused the transcriptional changes in the genes encoding energy metabolism and the biosynthesis pathway. And an osmosis protectant such as a glycine betaine can be used to alleviate the inhibition on coexisting bacteria, but not on the DHC 185. And the amendment of vitamin B12 and GB can be used as a biostimulating strategy to sustain the TCE decoronation performance during the salt perturbation at a concentration up to 400 millimolar. Okay, so here comes to the end of this presentation. I'd like to thank Professor Lisa Evers-Cohen for her vision and advice on this research. and all the current and past students working on this project, including Mohan Sun, Dr. Xinwei Mao, and Alexandra Palacico. Also, I'd like to thank NIEHS Superfund R1 program and UC Berkeley Superfund Research Center for financial support. And also, thank you for your time and attention. With that, I'd like to take questions.
Thank you, Sean. And again, thank you to the team and to Lisa for her leadership on this project. And we got a couple of questions that came in. One was about iron reduction that occurs simultaneously with sulfate reduction producing a ferrous sulfide precipitate. How common would this sulfide toxicity be in natural environments?
That's a very good question. Actually, so in the environment where iron is abundant, so we think this sulfide inhibitory effect was not significant. So it's insignificant. So the formation, the precipitation of iron sulfate actually can help to detoxify the sulfide effect. But in the environment where iron is absent, so the impact might be more significant.
Okay, that makes sense. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible that these microbes can acclimate to higher TDS over time?
What is a TDS?
I'm guessing this is total dissolved salt. Total dissolved solids, but I don't know that applies here.
Yeah, right. Yes. All this experiments was performed in solid-free enrichment, solid-free culture. So, but previously in our lab, we have some culture enrichment cultures from groundwater and containing aquifer solids, and we actually saw pretty similar effect on the sulfate reduction condition. Actually, the enrichment culture I used here, there are some high TDS compared to the pure culture or co-culture usually maintained in the lab. So we think TDS might not be might not impact a huge influence on the results we saw here.
Okay, and along the lines about talking about salts, you focus mostly on sodium. So what about sodium chloride or any other dissolved ions?
So we only tested on sodium chloride in the salt salinity study. So we haven't tried other ions such as potassium or other counter ion. But previous study on the EVH culture have shown that there was not a significant difference between sodium and potassium in terms of the impact to DVH. So since the DVH is a very important hydrogen producer in the in this centrifugal interaction, so we think in terms of an electron donor, the presence of potassium wouldn't impact that much. So for the ion in our lab, we also test some of the anion, such as carbonate or bicarbonate, and they didn't show any negative impact on the TCE dechlorination.
Okay. Thank you. I think at this point we can open up for all three presenters. Thank you again, Sean, for that wonderful presentation and for giving us an idea about, you know, what some of the limitations are for these very important consortia. We did have one question for Ed Bauer, if he's still in the house.
Yes,
Ed,
I am.
Hi, Ed.
Hi.
So when you were going through and talking about all the different other applications, other contaminants that might be potentially useful for your dual aerobic anaerobic biofilm. Would you also include pentachlorophenols in that group?
I guess you could. I don't know as much about that. Pentachlorophenol is a little more hydrophilic because of the OH group. I'm assuming it does go through reductive dechlorination. So any compound that has the potential for reductive dechlorination, it does make sense that that could happen, yes.
Great. Thank you. That was one follow-up question for you. And we had another one for Frank, another couple, actually. Frank, what is the advantage of using high-throughput qPCR over RNA-seq?
Okay, so the big difference right now between the sequencing technologies and quantitative PCR is that, as the name says, PCR, quantitative PCR, provides absolute quantitative information. So that means that you can go to a well over time, take samples, and you determine the exact numbers of your target analyte, be it a gene or a transcript. When you do sequencing, it's not an absolute quantitative number that you're obtaining. You can only compare the number of sequences within a sample. Okay, so you can say, what, this transcript has 10% abundance, the other one has 50% abundance, or something like that. But you do not get absolute quantitative numbers. So it's still challenging to develop the sequencing approach so that you can do time series sampling and directly compare between these different sampling points based only on relative quantitative information. With qPCR, for every sampling point, you get absolute quantitative information and can directly compare. That's the big difference. So within a sample, you can do relative comparisons based on relative abundance, but it's difficult to use this sequencing approach to compare between samples that were collected over time or from different sites. So that remains a major advantage of the qPCR approach.
Great, thank you. And there were a couple of questions about the B12. One was more a comment where this person has two cases where B12 was limiting in high sulfate environments over 2,000 milligrams per liter. And they found that the B12 addition was effective in stimulating complete dechlorination in the field. So that was a comment just to add to, you know, some of the observations you were making. And then there is a question with regard to the vitamin B12. The question is, would the addition of the lower ligands work better than vitamin B12 to encourage growth of dechlorinators in the field?
Okay, so the first one, I guess, was not a question, but I have a question.
Correct.
About this comment. So if there's clear evidence that the addition of vitamin B12 alone stimulated reductive dechlorination, I would be very interested in learning more specifics about this. If the vitamin B12 was added together with electron donor, what is often done, then it's very difficult to disentangle the effects of the vitamin addition compared to the electron donor addition. So if anybody knows about a case where vitamin addition alone had a very positive effect on reductive dechlorination activity, I mean, please email me because I would like to find out more about this. So the second question was the idea of not adding vitamin B12 or another carotenoid, instead just adding the lower base that the helicocoides could use to assemble functional carbamides that would support reductive dechlorination activity. This is a very good idea, and we can show in the laboratory that this can work. I have doubt that this will be very productive in situ, because when you add these lower bases, they are essentially carbon sources, carbon and energy sources for other organisms. They will just use them up eat them before the eleukocoides can take advantage of them. Now, this has never been tested. So what I'm saying is kind of my prediction what would happen. So maybe there's a need to explore this in more detail in the laboratory and in situ if the addition of a suitable lower base would be a productive strategy to stimulate the eleukocoides under conditions where the correct cobamide is limiting. So this is a good idea and may have valued for or merit for further exploration.
Great. Well, at this point, I would like to again thank our presenters, Ed, Frank, and Sean, for presenting. We really enjoyed also all the questions that came in from so many very attentive audience members, so we certainly appreciate that as well. Before we conclude, I wanted to make sure that everyone is aware of the related URLs pod, which contains seminar resources and seminar feedback links. On the seminar resources page, we have assembled resources directly applicable to today's topic. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation. We will place these seminars in an archive with the soundtrack, so in the near future, you will be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today. Also in the related URL pod, you will find an online seminar feedback form. We ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form. We do look at your comments as we continue to improve the content and delivery mechanisms. And we'd like for you to stay connected with us. We have not only through our other EPA CLUIN webinars, but also through our monthly e-newsletter, Tech Direct, and CLUIN on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. We also encourage you to visit the SRP website for more information about the program. You can also follow us on Twitter. And would like to let you know about our upcoming sessions. On May 13th, we'll be talking about bioavailability of mixtures, looking at both PAHs, another study working with chlorinated compounds, and lastly, work on mixtures of metals and bioavailability. So we hope you can enjoy that one. That one's on May 13th. And then on May 20th, we'll have two researchers talking about mercury bioremediation and biotransformation in the environment. And we encourage you to register for those, just like today's webinar. They're all free, and encourage you to send it to your colleagues as well. If you would like to join the upcoming webinars, if you cannot attend, archives will be made later after the event, so we encourage you to come back to these pages for links to the archives where the webinars will be held. So with that, it's time to conclude today's webinar. Thank you so much again to all the people who submitted questions. If you didn't get a chance to ask a question, we do encourage you to contact the speakers. Again, their email addresses are on the seminar homepage in CLUIN. We would like to thank the folks from CLUIN and Sarah Mishmandani, Sarah Omalagbe, sorry, I used the wrong name, who's been doing a great job behind the scenes with our CLUIN. And then last but not least, of course, we would like to thank our presenters, Ed Bauer, Frank Loeffler, and Sean Yee for their